top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die, only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here is episode 364 of the Really Awful Movies Podcast. Hostel, dynamite title right off the bat with a double entendre, depending on what accented English you speak, but hostile territory, hostile, those downmarket, often ramshackle places you lay your head at night when you're on backpacking excursions, and I'm definitely familiar with the gamut of them, from the worst, which was an extremely loud and very boisterous and very, very, very impossible to sleep in a milieu in Bangkok, to one of the better ones, I think, in New York City, if memory serves, which was shared accommodations with a lovely Australian couple who were somewhat aghast by our desire to, I guess, to then traipse around the pre-gentrified parts of the East Village and Alphabet City in New York, since, I think, taken over by probably a glut of Bed Baths and Beyonds. Bed, Bath, and Beyonds? From beyond the grave. Anyway, I figured I would tackle this movie because I was actually going to dive into a subgenre of film derisively referred to as torture porn by way of Takashi Miike, who incidentally is actually in this movie, and through his infamous film called Ichi the Killer. And that was one that I intended to rewatch, but I couldn't compel myself to because it's just such a over-the-top piece of violent art that I just, I don't know if I was in the right headspace for it. It's just something that didn't sit well with me the first time I watched it, and I wasn't sure I had the right mindset to be able to engage my critical faculties with it. So next in line, I figured I would take a right turn, a wrong turn maybe, over to Hostel, which I've always preferred to the Saw movies, what with their Rube Goldbergian, I guess, over-reliance, I would say, on coincidence, and the over-reliance, I think, on the personality-driven storytelling of the antagonist in that one, whereas I think in Hostel, the fact that the film relies on a secret cabal of sadistic killers in Central Europe, I think serves serves the narrative a lot better. And Eli Roth, full disclosure here, we were at one time, our podcast was part of one of his horror networks, and we promoted it quite substantially, and in return, you know, it was like one of those things where I went on vacation, all I got was this lousy t-shirt, but we, in fact, I don't even care to name them now, but we were part of the network, and we thought that the imprimatur of quality would come from being associated with him, and that some of that would land on us. But in retrospect, I think at the time it was a bit kind of a naive thinking, because in no way informed our viewing of his films. We always never really championed him, but never really derided him either. He is a quintessential, a kind of B-level director, and I'm not talking about B in terms of old-timey vernacular around the B pictures that would, you know, not like an A-list picture, but he makes stuff that's good, consistently good, but never great. Like, you'll never go, wow, that was just a revelation of cinema, and that runs the gamut from his work in both Hostel movies that he wrote and directed, but I thought Green Inferno, again, good, not great. Cabin Fever, good, not great. The Death Wish reboot, that kind of thing, good, not great, fine. They're all just fine movies, and despite this, Quentin Tarantino whose, I think, egomania gets the better of him on frequent occasions, basically put his name all over this one in large, fulsome, impossible-to-miss font, like presented by Quentin Tarantino, far eclipsing his charge, Eli Roth, despite his comments about him being the second coming in horror, as if he's like Brandon Cronenberg or Ari Aster or some such thing. That said, that's a large, large caveat right off the bat, but I think Hostel actually has a lot going for it, and I think upon revisiting, I think I was a little bit too hasty in my dismissal of it. I want, in part, to revisit this, not only because we seldom get a chance to talk about torture porn-style films because of Jeff and I's antipathy to the genre. We think it's much like using the F-bomb in comedy. It's kind of a way to get a cheap laugh when you have someone tied to a chair and you're just putting them through a litany of abuse. I think that's a cheap way, in my opinion anyway, to generate horror. And I think there's much more savvy, much more dutiful ways of doing this, as Mr. John Carpenter knows very well in some of his films, not to mention David Cronenberg and the like. I've actually been to Bratislava, Slovakia, which is kind of neat. I mean, it's depicted as Eastern Europe in this film, although residents would likely take umbrage with that because it technically is Central Europe. And the transition from Western Europe's civility and all your creature comforts met, and then as you slowly slide your way eastward and again through Central Europe and then to Moldova and Romania and these kinds of countries, you realize both the sliding scale of wealth, but also the robust influence that the ex-Soviet Union had on this part of the world. I mean, Slovakia, before it split from the Czechoslovakia, was a satellite or was occupied by the Soviets until the late 80s when they had the Velvet Revolution. And their stamp is all over it with this kind of brutalist architecture. And my friend Chris and I, a good pal of mine from high school, who was my roommate at the time, we were on a backpacking sojourn, much like the kids in this film, but nowhere near as randy, right? But we actually stayed at one of these Soviet bloc, grayish slab of an ugly communist hotel. And it was pretty funny because we actually had a vent that instead of being on the ceiling was actually on the floor. So when I had to get to my bed near the window, I had to actually step over, and it was about a foot and a half to 2 feet high, a vent that was carpeted over. So clearly they had no designs on how this how this building would be structured. It was also somewhat alarming, and it could have put us in the mentality of being like a bit of foreshadowing, but the elevator was not exactly top drawer, shall we say, top shelf. I mean, it was a little bit like being John Malkovich, that movie that has the 9th and a half floor. It similarly, the elevator would take you to our floor, but would pull up a little bit short so that you had to step up a foot to get to your floor. So the entire, I guess, theme of our sojourn through Eastern/Central Europe was stepping over things that shouldn't have been built that way. So you do have this kind of donut effect in the city of Bratislava, where it transitions from beautiful, charming, medieval core, and then this donut outside of it of this communist block, commie block, hellhole kind of. And I think Eli Roth deftly set his film here, although I'm not sure he really had that totally in mind as a kind of demarcation or liminal point through which, like a portal from transporting oneself from the wealth and riches and comfort of Central and Western Europe, your Germany's, your Austria's, and whatnot, and going more into the off the beaten path, as it was for the time, Slovakia. Now, our story, our narrative, follows the exploits of these two pals, their names are, Paxton, I believe, and Josh. So, and they're, one of them, I don't know where Josh is from, but Paxton is a Southern California resident, Latino type guy. They're good pals, and they're just basically traipsing around Europe. And the film underscores that they're really in it for the Well, as they refer to it, and these are not my words, they're in it for the pussy, they're in there for the hedonism, and they are venturing all over the Netherlands, obviously, because Amsterdam is sort of a ground zero for this kind of hedonistic display, and still is. Like, I, full disclosure, I've been to the red light district, and no, not for what you'd think, but just as a slum touristing kind of detached observer, and I think it's something that really would make someone question their belief system about the sex trade and how it dehumanizes and demeans. Because I think once you see someone who can be bought and sold from behind glass, just like a mass consumer product, it really speaks to just how much having it cloaked in legitimacy really cheapens and undervalues a human life. But that's a story for another day. So you have these guys who, on their sojourn, they meet up with Ole, who's an Icelandic gentleman, if you want to call it that. He's got a daughter back home, and yet he operates like he's 10 years his junior, running around with college students he really shouldn't be associating with, because he should be a responsible dad, and just basically looking to sow his wild oats. And the three get together, and they're tipped off by this Eastern European stereotype guy who speaks heavily a vampiric accented English, and he meets them in the hostel and sounds off about the beauty and the allure of Slovakian and Central European women, and how that when they hear American accented English, they just fall all over themselves with glee. And he entices them, and it's not really, it's kind of ambiguous to the extent that he's involved with maybe some of the perpetrators later in the film, but in any way, I don't know if he functions as a fixer, but he's creepy enough to, and he sends these men off the beaten path, off the reservation, as it were, and taking a train into then underdeveloped Slovakia. And this is a film that takes place right on the heels of Saw, and has many of the trappings of some of the things that Jeff and I don't particularly care for, but torture porn, again, the aforementioned tying someone to a chair and hacking away at their Achilles tendons so they can't run, is what happens to one of the characters. And there's a bigger, broader implications here of I guess a metaphor and a subtext about how Americans treat the broader world frequently, or at least the ugly American stereotype when they're traveling, and always comparing it to the what they feel is far superior homestead, which makes you wonder why A, they travel at all, and B, if they're going to be constantly in that mindset, what they could possibly have to gain from a broader, more global outlook. But that's the stereotype. That's not true, obviously, of many of the Americans I met abroad, but there's a certain segment of ugly tourist, and include, I think, largely Brits and Americans and some Aussies too, who treat the world as their as a garbage heap and just basically run roughshod over different parts of it, and treating the locals badly and just basically behaving abysmally. Now, these guys don't do that so much. I mean, the Paxton character actually has a bit of worldliness to him, and can speak a pretty passable level of German, and he gets uses that to his advantage later on in the film. And you have these guys en route to Slovakia. They meet up with this fellow traveler who joins them in their train cabin, and he eats his food with his hands in a very strange manner. And he says that it's important to eat meat, and there's this whole discussion around meat, and he decries Paxton's vegetarian outlook and predilections. And this is something that Eli Roth visits in Green Inferno too, where it kind of he uses a bunch of Save the Whale do-gooders as the group he's sending up, rather than this type of some person, a traveler on the other side of the spectrum, maybe a more misogynistic kind of someone who's not really in it at all for the art and the cultural sensibilities, as they actually allude to in the film. That's really off their radar, and what they're really in it for is to get laid and to just sow their wild oats as much as possible. Now, they meet this gentleman on the train. He actually makes a pass at Josh, and they have this really intense encounter with this fellow, and he storms off, and he's creepy enough with his the way he moves his hands, the way he looks at the his fellow travelers there, the two Americans and the Icelandic gentleman. That's sort of a way, I think, Eli Roth telegraphs things, I think, a little bit too much in this case, but it's something that comes into play later. And sure enough, you have this honeypot type of trap where the two women with stereotypical names, I think it's Natalia and Svetlana, and who are way too attractive and way too model-esque to want anything to really have anything to do with these two kind of 90s pop punk stereotype looking guys with their white long sleeved shirts and their t-shirts over top, as was the style at the time, unfortunately, in the mid 2000s. But the fact that they would find anything in common with, or find any sort of camaraderie with this group is something that the travelers don't even take note of. And as someone who's been solicited by ladies of the evening, shall we say, in different places, like, you have your guard up, because you know, and this happened to me in both New Orleans and New York City, when there's someone who's too good looking and too polished, you know, to possibly be interested. Not that, you know, I think I'm a handsome enough guy, but you know, even, you know, I know my station and I know my lane, right? And if there's someone who's just absolutely impeccably dressed and they're talking to me and laughing at all my jokes way too prematurely, I'm obviously going to get my eyebrows, raise suspicions. These guys see nothing of it, and I don't see them as having too much game, but they see nothing of it in the fact that everyone just falls to the floor, and is so smitten and so taken with their charms. So they're taken in, and much like in the way the Squid Game plays with this conceit, but there's a group of, again, this cabal of nefarious evildoers who actually pay to play, and they pay for the privilege of preying on Westerners and actually sawing them up in this dungeon-type milieu. And Eli Roth actually handles this in a very, very cool kind of way. The scene setting and the mise-en-scene for the torture chamber-style stuff is actually... It has a cinematography that's very like a Dante's vision of hell. It's dark, it's foreboding, it's rusty, it's dirty, and it carries these kinds of sepia tones that I think really really allows this movie to age better than the likes of Saw and those kinds of films from the mid-2000s, where I think the nascent color-correcting digital technology was just coming to its own and being frequently and overly abused by a number of productions. I mean, I'm looking at you, Saw. And a number of the Saw sequels actually were filmed in Toronto, and it's kind of funny to revisit them and see, hey, there's Metro Hall. I used to work near there, and this kind of thing. But the cinematography is just one of the many ways that I think the Saw franchise lets people down. I'm not a fan, and to the extent I'm not really a fan of this style of film either, is kind of odd, because Green Inferno, when you think about it, is a tribute to the Ruggiero Deodato cannibal style movies, like your Cannibal Ferox and Cannibal Holocaust and that, and they've frequently been likened to torture porn in of themselves, but they don't have as much in the way of protracted, expansive, I guess, kidnapping type torture sensibilities. They do, but there's enough other things wrong with them. That's a story for another day, that I think it takes the attention away from just that. But I think, again, it does speak to the fact that you don't really need to have a deft touch and subtlety to be able to generate scares from this kind of conceit. So what you have is really Paxton losing his friend Josh, because Josh is lured into this hell, and he's used for various torturous means, and there's obvious, I guess, kind of heavy-handed allusions to maybe the SS and what would have happened in World War II with Nazi experimental doctors and your Goerings and all these highfalutin Nazi people at the time. So that's kind of interesting and creepy, and definitely something that they take advantage of. I think with the Hostel sequel, they try to generate the same kind of, I guess, grim foreboding and momentum, although by actually having women as the protagonist. I think that really undercuts pardon the pun, the fear level generated, because women anywhere all the time have a greater sense of responsibility and concern because they're most frequently likely to be victims of this type, especially in horror. So when you have men who are the victims, I think it's much more impactful because it's something that's not as often seen. So when they try and, I guess, have lightning in a bottle twice, although I'm not going to, you know, laud this film too extensively, but I think the sequel suffers and doesn't have that same kind of emotional impact as when you have men who have this sort of cavalier devil may care attitude, which is exemplified and amplified by the fact that they're on vacation and their critical faculties are less honed in as much as they would be if they were, let's say, traveling around back at home in a seedy part of LA or something. So they think they're untouchable, they think nothing's going to happen to them, and they think that basically they can get away with anything. It really does have very little exposition, this film. So definitely a part of the thing, the aspects I liked, but there wasn't some dialogue meant merely to further the plot, and they actually have a lot of, scenes that you have to fill in kind of on a gestalt side of things where your brain is playing tricks on you almost in the same way of that Tobe Hooper's Texas Chainsaw Massacre does. And I think Eli Roth was very, very much influenced by Hooper when he was coming up as a filmmaker. At least it seems to, it appears that way. So as the narrative unspools, you get this Paxton character who's the final guy, as it were, and he has to try and navigate his way out of this hell. And their friend Ole goes missing as well, and they have all these messages from him that are inexplicably terse and not really in his voice. And they sort of wonder where he's been to, and they're not getting any help from the hostile front desk. And they're basically at a loss in unfamiliar territory, not being able to speak the language. Now, for the most part, that is. Paxton actually does speak pretty passable German in this. And in when he finds himself in this torture chamber and the German antagonist is going to chop him up with a chainsaw, they have a pretty neat exchange that I had to really like strain to hear, where he actually pleads with his life and says, you know, if you kill me, it'll just destroy your life. And every time you close your eyes, you'll see me. And I was like straining to grasp this. It's like, wenn du mich tötest, wird das dein Leben zerstören. Jedes Mal, wenn du deine Augen schließt, wirst du mich sehen. So every time you close your eyes, you'll see me. And I thought, oh, that's kind of neat. And I don't think they subtitled it. And it actually, I'm not sure if this is something that would have been to its debit or credit, but it seems like these guys were maybe more worldly than they let on, at least the Paxton character. And maybe he's actually been rewarded for having a more worldly or global view of things. I'm not sure if that's too deep a reading into it, but I definitely like certain aspects of this film more than I thought it would. Again, the cinematography and the graininess comes across a lot better than I think the awful cinematography lets down Saw. Another thing I learned, while it's par for the course in horror to punish moral turpitude, I think Hostel could have stood to have at least one character who might have been a little more sympathetic than Josh. I think there could have been, I think, a more gentlemanly way of going about their business, and they could have handled themselves and carried themselves a little bit better as men. And fine, everyone wants to go travel and get laid, right? But they didn't have to be so laddish about it. Before we close, I guess I'll have to give a star rating for this one. I guess upon initial viewing, I was somewhat underwhelmed, but I think the broader themes of depending on to what extent you can read into American attitudes of exceptionalism and willingness to engage with the broader world. I still think this is one that can easily be given a 3.25, maybe. I think that's pretty much fair. 3.25. That seems about right. Anyway, continue to listen to the Really Awful Movies podcast, and don't forget to pick up a copy of our book. Or both books, actually, Death by Umbrella and also Mine's Bigger Than Yours. And take care. We'll talk to you soon. Thank you.
Thank you.